600 spot on your dial. WICC, Bridgeport, Connecticut.
I'm Bud Finch, and I'll be back right after Andy Carano's news. Next, over the sound of New Haven, WELI.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Bob Steele of WTIC Hartford, speaking to you from the Army's Bradley Field in central Connecticut, where 25 or 30 big four-engine bombers have arrived in the past hour or so. More are coming in all the time.
The latest news from the WTHT Hartford Times newsroom.
Town Hartford, we bring you Hartford Speaks, transcribed. I'm Bob Maher. Here's Una King.
Well, you bright little spring boy, you're anticipating it a little bit, aren't you?
That's number 83, everybody, at WTIC, the Dickie Robinson Countdown Show, as we check out the top 100 records for 1967.
The Ken Griffin Show. WPOP.
From high atop Radio Mountain at 95.7, this is WBMI Hartford, Meriden. My name is Dan Bloom.
Connecticut Radio Memories, a series chronicling the first six decades of Connecticut's radio stations, as told by the people behind the microphones and behind the scenes. Episode 1, Doolittle's Dream and Parker's Promise, the story of Connecticut's oldest radio station. During the first two decades of the 20th century, radio was in its infancy, and was primarily for point-to-point communications that transmitted messages between two people. Government, the military, scientific experimenters, and shipping companies were using radio, but ordinary people didn't have radios. It wasn't until the early 1920s that the concept of broadcasting, sending entertainment and information out to vast numbers of people in their homes, came into being. Once this idea started, companies and individuals all over the country set up radio stations to promote their businesses, and Connecticut was no exception to this trend.
There were several that were among the first, WAAQ in Greenwich, which was owned by the New England Motor Sales Company. Then there was WCJ in New Haven, owned by the A.C. Gilbert Company.
Radio historian Bob Payne.
There was also a WQB, and that was owned by Clarence D. Tuska, who was instrumental in the founding of the American Radio Relay League. There was a WGAH in New Haven, WDAK in Hartford, owned by the Hartford Current.
During the 1970s, a caller to WTIC's Dick Bertel show recalled WDAK.
I distinctly remember WDAK.
Yeah?
In fact, I was in that studio, and it was located in the current building on State Street.
Mm-hmm.
And it had the transmitting antenna on the roof, and it could be seen from the street. It was a circular thing with, say, about four or five wires around it, strung between two poles on the roof.
The University of Connecticut, which was then the Connecticut Agricultural College, had WCAC from the 20s up until around 1935-36, when they turned in their license. The only station prior to 1925 that's still operating is WPAJ in New Haven, and that later became WDRC.
Franklin Doolittle put the radio station on the air.
Former WDRC Vice President and General Manager Wayne Mulligan.
In 1922, down in New Haven. That was, of course, the AM station.
Right.
Well, he was born in 1893.
Franklin Doolittle's son, John Doolittle.
He was born in New Haven, grew up in a family which I judge was musically oriented. I know at one point his father made a violin, and his sister became a piano teacher, and so he was always interested in sound. And as a young boy, obviously having the brain to do it, he was very interested in making things, and the development of early radio with Marconi and so on had been coming along, and I guess it interested him greatly, and he started tinkering and so on.
The interesting thing about Franklin Malcolm Doolittle is that he was an innovator, a pioneer in a really young industry, radio broadcasting.
Radio historian Ed Bruder.
You have to remember that his training included stints as a ship-to-shore operator.
When he went to Yale, he spent summers as a radio operator on transatlantic liners or commercial ships.
He was a Morse code operator, sending messages back from the pilot to the ports, telling him when they'd be in, on what day, and how much cargo they were carrying.
My mother related this to me in her final years, that when she had been going out with my father, she wanted to kind of check up on him. So she asked somebody that knew him what he was like, and the answer she got back was that he was a dreamer who made his dreams come true.
And he was one of these folks who saw the commercial potential in using the radio airwaves with spoken voice and other entertainment type of medium in order to communicate with vast numbers of people instead of using them as very limited, targeted communication outlets. But, of course, Doolittle didn't have any more idea where commercial radio was going in 1922 when he started his station in New Haven than anybody else did at that time. At first, it was called WPAJ.
WPAJ, which was operated in the back of a radio electronics store that he operated in New Haven.
I know it went to two or three locations before it moved into the Hotel Taft.
And in 1925, the call letters were changed to WDRC, standing for the Doolittle Radio Corporation.
So all the while he's in New Haven operating, and was affiliated with National Broadcasting Company at one point in time.
At the time, the networks were very big players because a lot of programming came from the network. On an average day, perhaps 60 to 70% of the station's total programming output would have come from the network, and the remaining 30 or 40% came from the local station. CBS did not have an affiliate in the Hartford-Springfield market. And frankly, they saw it as a more lucrative market, and that's where they wanted an outlet, than New Haven, because New Haven really, in some senses, was a suburb of New York where there was a CBS affiliate.
So around 1930, he picked up and moved and went to Hartford.
So Doolittle was very easily talked into moving his station to Hartford, because he could serve the Hartford-Springfield market from that point and become the CBS affiliate, which would be a lucrative thing for both the network and for his station.
They moved in to 11 Asylum Street, which later was where WCCC operated out of. I don't know if it was the same floor and studios, but they stayed there for about 6 years before they moved to 750 Main Street.
And as they say, the rest is history.
Former WDRC announcer Lonnie Jerev.
The programming was, a lot of it was live.
WDRC also had a string ensemble.
Former WDRC announcer Jack Lenhoff.
Composed of members of the Hartford Symphony Orchestra. Joe Bloom, whose son has been a communications attorney, Dan Bloom.
My father, Joseph Bloom, who was a violinist, actually, was a very historic person.
Dan Bloom.
He played for the band that opened the Bushnell. He played in the band that put WTIC-AM on the air. And he's a charter member of the Hartford Symphony. And he also used to say he also played at the opening of the Hartford Civic Center, Roof 1 and Roof 2. He played also at the WDRC, was the orchestra leader there. Keep in mind, of course, that at this time, it was not allowed to play phonograph recordings on the air. James C. Petrillo, the powerhouse president of the Musicians Union, would not allow it, so all the radio stations had to have studio orchestras and bands.
In addition to WDRC AM, Doolittle was a pioneer in FM broadcasting and built the first FM station in Connecticut.
The Doolittle Radio Corporation, the DRC folks, had been experimenting with FM broadcasting as early as 1939.
Mr. Doolittle, as I say, was a very shy man, but a brilliant man.
He was a brilliant engineer.
And surrounded himself with professionals. Italo Martino. Marty Martino was his chief engineer.
And Doolittle was very friendly with Armstrong, who, of course, invented and created FM.
He and Armstrong developed radar. Of course, led to FM, of which he was very proud.
And what happened was that Armstrong talked Doolittle into putting up a 2,000-watt FM station transmitter on Meriden Mountain.
I was invited to come. I was working on a boat.
He had a yacht, and the name of the yacht was the Decibel, D-E-C-I-B-E-L, which is audio measurement.
It was owned by the owner, WDRC, and going to Hillier College at the time.
Stanley Peer.
And he approached me and wanted to know if I'd like to try radio engineering. And so I got into radio business that way. The studios at that time were at 750 Main Street in Hartford. Both FM and AM were there. And then the transmitters, of course, were in Bloomfield and Meriden Mountain. And you had to have a technician on duty at both locations in those days. They weren't operated by remote control as they are today. And I was a radio engineer at the studio, and I did some work at the FM station when it was being installed on Meriden Mountain at the time, with Martino and Armstrong were involved in the installation over there.
Armstrong at one point visited Meriden Mountain, where the FM transmitter is located.
He was there at the time. I was only 20 years old. I was just around there helping with some of the wiring. I didn't know too much about it. They told me what to do, and I was doing it. I was there prior to the construction when the whole transmitter was being built and the antenna was being put up, and also when they fired the cannon, the Coast Guard fired the cannon from the cliff into Southington and brought the power line up.
So that was to string a wire, basically?
Yeah, they strung a breacher's buoy. They call it a breacher's buoy line. and they fired it off in the distance, so I think around 1,200 feet, and they were able to pick up the end of the wire and then use that for pulling up the first electric line there or cable so they could bring more wiring up to the top of the mountain. And it's being used to this day, the same wires.
And my father's orchestra or band, I don't know how many were in, how many players there were, played over the FM station at one point, and that live broadcast was picked up by Armstrong in Cataract, New Jersey, where his initial FM station was located. And we seem to feel that was the first ever FM network broadcast in the world.
What follows is the conclusion of a 1941 recording of one of Armstrong and Doolittle's FM radio tests that involved the Meriden Mountain site.
And I just want to thank the boys on Mount Washington, Mike at Paxton, John Denny at Meriden, and the boys at Alpine. And to say that the next time that we do this, I think we can have added in a few added innovations, which I'd like to talk over with you, Paul, out at Columbus.
All right, then it's a date.
When we get back, we'll do it again, and with the innovations that I mentioned.
All right,
good night, everybody.
Good night from Boston.
Good night, Major. This is the Mount Washington.
And good night from Paxton.
Good night from Meriden.
Because that's when their first station, W1XPW, signed on. And over the years, the station evolved. It became W65H. Then in 1943, it became WDRC-FM. At different times, it broadcast at 94.3 megahertz and later at 93.7.
As a CBS Radio Network's Hartford affiliate, WDRC was the local station that on October 30th, 1938, broadcast Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater's radio adaptation of The War of the Worlds. All around the country, panicked listeners phoned police, newspapers, and radio stations to find out what was going on. Phone calls even came into radio stations that weren't even broadcasting the play, including Hartford's WTHT, just down the street from WDRC. WTHT engineer Al Cohen remembers.
I was on duty in the control room that night when Orson Welles did The War of the Worlds. And
a bulletin has handed me. Martian cylinders are falling all over the country. One outside of Buffalo, one in Chicago.
That switchboard just lit up. We just couldn't get to the phones fast enough. As soon as you hung up on one, there's another one. Yeah, no, ma'am, it's only a play. It's only, it's not so. The men from Mars are not here. That's only Orson Welles. And we just repeated that over and over again. I don't know how many phone calls we had. We had loads. There were probably only a couple of us on duty at night, and yeah, so we were pretty busy little boys.
Though the 1938 Martian radio invasion was fake, real war came to the airwaves only a few years later.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Stanley Peer remembers.
Biggest thing was the day that we declared war, and that particular Sunday, December 7th, of course, we knew about it around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and I was on duty at the control board there, and we used teletypes in those days, and we had three different teletype services there, and all of a sudden, all the bells of the whole place started going crazy, and that's when war was declared, when the Pearl Harbor situation. And of course, only two of us were in the studio at the time, and then a lot of people arrived at the station, and the station, for some reason at the time, the doors were all locked up so nobody could get up in there. That was, I can remember all that happening.
As draft-age men from WDRC left to join the military, it opened up many announcing spots.
And so when World War II came along,
Jack Lenhoff,
and able-bodied males were drafted, there was an opening, even for a 16-year-old, which I was at the time. And I worked on W65H, which was FM.
When I got the job at WDRC, it was with the understanding that I would leave when the announcers and engineers who had been on the staff and enlisted came back.
Lonnie Giroux.
I was hired by WDRC to be a full-time staff announcer, and I think I was the first woman to be a full-time staff announcer in Connecticut.
Did you have any resistance from your fellow staff announcers, or were you accepted fairly quickly, or was it sort of an old boys club kind of thing?
It was an old boys club, especially at WDRC. I didn't realize it. I mean, everybody was very cordial, but I found afterward that they objected to my doing the newscasts, which we did in those days at the current building on State Street. We'd go up for the 11 o'clock news break, and all the presses would be running. They wanted me to be taken off the newscast, but Mr. Sheridan, who was the head of the Hartford Current at that time, liked me, so he prevailed. There was a lot of live work on radio then, and WDRC had a musical program in the afternoons, live music. And the musicians were mostly from what became the Hartford Symphony. And I was the announcer for that.
Jack Zaman, who was a well-known Hartford Current reporter and had some tie-in with WDRC.
He had a show there every evening from the Hartford Current, and he was a political writer. And we did remote programs with Jack Zaman down in the Marble Pillar, which was down on the side of the circle there, just underneath the side of the at 750 Main Street.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Larry Colton speaking from the Marble Pillar on Central Row in downtown Hartford, where Bill Sheehan and I are about to bring you by wire recorder another session of Main Street Hartford. Sponsored today by A.C. Peterson Farms. So here's Bill Sheehan.
Well, thank you, Larry. I certainly don't know what's going on around here. We have this wire recorder down here, and otherwise, I don't know what's going on. But here's a fellow right here who's been panned on this program before. Now we're going to get his pan on it. Jack, say a word.
Well, this is the Needle Club, as you know, Bill.
You're Jack Zaman, isn't that right?
That's right.
Bill, the Hartford Current.
Oh, thank you very much. Bill Sheehan, this is the Needle Club, which meets every noon at the Marble Pillar Restaurant. Carl Struve, the owner, is sitting right here beaming at us. So this is the group that meets every day to needle each other, Bill.
Oh, I see, Jack. Have all these fellas appeared on your program?
Well, a lot of them have. We've had Needle Club sessions, you know, every once in a while at the Scholar's Restaurant. But this is the luncheon meeting. We just give each other the business every day. Why don't you speak to Carl Struve, the owner of the establishment, and see how he likes it. He's sitting right here. Okay, Bill, go ahead.
Jack, thank you very much. You're Carl Struve, isn't that
right? Yes, my name is Carl.
Okay, Carl, you own the Marble Pillar?
I own the Marble Pillar. I'm just a restaurant since 1938.
1938?
Yes.
These fellows come in here every day?
Oh, they're friends.
They're friends.
They come in every day, and I'd like to have them here.
You don't want to throw them out, then?
Never, no.
If I figured out a way you could...
stick to the Marble Pillar.
If I figured a way that you could get rid of them, you wouldn't want to get rid of them anyway.
No, sure not.
Here's a gentleman right here. What's your name?
Paul Motto.
Mr. Motto, you're an alderman, is that right?
That's right.
Are you a Democrat or Republican?
All Republican.
What do you think of the new mayor?
Oh, very lovely fellow.
You like the new mayor.
But I don't want to miss this opportunity, especially to thank the voters, especially the Democratic voters that came to the polls in Judge Bailey's automobiles in the south end of the city to vote for Mr. Moylan and myself.
What can you say? What can you say to a thing like that? You're going to run for mayor someday?
Well, that all depends on John Bailey's friends, too.
Okay, Mr. Motto, thank you very much. Larry, where are you? One more we'll have time for, I guess.
One more? That would be this gentleman right here. Everyone seems very anxious for me to have him on the air. Now, your name, sir?
John M. Bailey.
John M. Bailey. Well, I've heard a lot of talking about you, not only here at the table today, but also on some of Jack's broadcasts, the Headliners Club and the Needle Club broadcasts that we do every Thursday evening on the station. By the way, there's one tonight, isn't there?
Well, we understand. You know, we have to keep Zaman busy, because otherwise he wouldn't keep that job with the Current if we didn't keep him in the air.
And this is the way you accomplish it, on these daily meetings, are they?
That's
over
right. I mean, we feel sorry for him since Moylan and the Republicans threw him out of the mayor's office. He won't give any news.
He hasn't any place to go now but the Marble Pillar,
He got too far out on the end of a limb. He thought the fellas he was going to win put all his cards on the table on that, and now Moylan won't even talk to him.
WDRC engineer Stanley Peer remembers some of the other people at WDRC during the 1930s and 40s.
Well, I worked with Harry Broderick, and he was the studio engineer in charge in Hartford. Of course, we had a lot of the announcers who were around there. I'm just trying to think. Bill Sheehan was one of them, and Harvey Olson was another one. Walter Hath was the manager of the station, and well, we always ran a morning program with Harvey Olson.
Harvey H. Olson.
Oh, yes, he was the chief announcer.
He used to do a morning show, and he was a competition for Bob Steele. And his sign-off routine was, "This is Longfellow saying so long, fellow, and bye, Bob."
As a matter of fact, he referred to himself as Longfellow.
Former WDRC newscaster Fred Swanson.
Very nice guy. A radio-type voice, too.
How come you're not in school? I hope you're not sick.
Yes, that's what I am. I'm getting over a cold.
Oh, I hope you're a lot better, though.
Yes.
Feeling much better?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we want you to enjoy Christmas along with John and all the other members of the family. But right now, we hope we can pick things up a little bit, pick spirits up a little bit with Gene Autry's recording of Rudolph. How's that?
All right.
Well, thank you very much, Betsy, for calling.
Goodbye.
Bye now. And so for Betsy and John Doolittle, here's Gene Autry's very, very popular recording of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
But, oh, Harvey was program director there, and prior to that, chief announcer.
Well, chief announcer, but also he was what they referred to as the first program director. The second program director was Charlie Parker.
Charlie Parker was there?
Charlie Parker was a dear. In fact, he and I started at WDRC on the same day. Yes. Oh, Charlie and his wife, I was very fond of them.
He grew up, loved radio, went into World War II when I think he was like maybe only 17. I don't even know if he's 18 yet.
Charlie Parker's son, Steve Parker.
And after he got out of the Navy, World War II was still on, and he was looking for a job and was walking around downtown Hartford. I think he had looked for a job at the, maybe a tobacco store or something. He was just trying to find work. And he'd always loved radio, and he saw WDRC. It was up at 750 Main Street then, and he called upstairs to see if he could have a tour of the radio station, because he was a radio man in the Navy, too. He knew all the, you know, he used to be able to fly through the points of the compass, and he could do Morse code and all this stuff. We were always amazed as kids how he could, you know, do all these neat radio things. But he really wanted to see the radio station. They gave him a tour and offered him a job on the spot. And the funny thing was, the woman who actually opened the door for him and answered the phone was my mom.
Well, it comes time now for MOTR to serenade two grand people, Patty Welch and Charlie Parker, who today announced their engagement. Congratulations, Patty and Charlie.
Thank you very much, Larry.
They fell in love there, and I get married and have my sister and I.
What, are we going to have a whole mob in here? Come on in, girls. Come on in.
Yeah.
Here's Harvey Olson, Mr. Hatt, and Nikki Nickerson, Betty Kelly, Rosemary Mansworth, Joy Woodall.
Fine.
Gene Presley. Marty, what are you doing in here? Yeah. You never on Earth with a visit.
Oh, Jimmy Garrett, Harry Potter.
Fine.
Eleanor Howard, Barbara McGowan. Say, this is a regular party, and I'm the only one that's got any cake.
Where's the
count? Well, they've all gobbled their cake down already, Larry. I just rushed in with that so that you wouldn't starve to death.
Way ahead of me, huh? So, you know, Patty, it occurred to me that no longer will I be able to call Charlie Parker the Pearl Street Caballero.
Well, you watch that, Larry. You watch that.
Well, it's certainly swell anyway, and I want to wish you two people the best of everything. And here's a little serenade for you.
Thank you very much, Larry, and thanks to everybody else.
Thanks, Larry.
Bye.
And I know you both like the same tune, and it's Artie Shaw's All the Things You Are.
So, literally, my mom and dad, full-blooded radio folks, so that's what flows through my veins. He started there as an engineer. And, used to be responsible for keeping the radio station on the air.
During the 1940s and 50s, Mr. Doolittle began preparations for bringing WDRC into the new medium of television.
For a number of years, they had worked on an application. He had actually secured some land out in Farmington for possible television use. The VHF, which was far more desirable because of its greater range and higher power, which was Channel 3, was up for grabs, and basically there were two prime competitors for it, one being WTIC, which was the Travelers Insurance Company station, and the other being my dad and his partners. And so he had submitted the application for that.
The Travelers and Doolittle both applied for Channel 3.
WTIC's Paul Morency discussed the competition with WDRC for Channel 3 in a recorded message to staff.
You all know that there have been some activities going on in the past week, and probably you've heard a great many rumors concerning them. And it's in order to give you all the information we can before it is publicly announced that I call this meeting. And I imagine that those who are not here will be able to hear it later from a tape recording or something. It might be as easy as anyway to read to you the press release, which will be issued for publication tomorrow morning, newspapers, and tonight on our 6 p.m. news. So in a very short time, this will be public news. This is the release which will be in tomorrow's Current in a fashion which they may or may not follow. In a joint announcement made yesterday, Monday, Franklin M. Doolittle, president of WDRC, and Paul W. Morency, vice president and general manager of WTIC, stated that their respective organizations have concluded an agreement which will join their radio and television activities in the event that WTIC's television application is granted by the Federal Communications Commission. Both organizations have been applicants for a TV station on Channel 3 in Hartford. The plan provides for the withdrawal by the Connecticut Broadcasting Company, DRC, of its application for a TV station and for a joint effort with WTIC to obtain a favorable decision on the application of the Travelers Broadcasting Service Corporation for a television station.
And the Travelers bought him out, and they bought him out by giving him stock. So that's what happened. That's where he ended up. He got stock, got Travelers stock, which made him, you know, in a roundabout way, it made him an owner of that broadcast facility. Right. And at that time, he couldn't do that, so therefore he had to divest DRC.
Right. First to be sold off was WDRC-FM, which had never been profitable for Doolittle.
When he finally sold it, he basically gave it away, having lost money on it probably all those years. I can recall one letter that he got from a lady extolling how much he enjoyed listening to the wonderful programming on WDRC-FM because it had no ads. And, of course, ads are the lifeblood of any station, and he got a big chuckle out of that because that was the reason she enjoyed it. But, of course, it was the reason that the station was not doing well financially.
1956, the station by that time was being called WFMQ. And the Doolittle Corporation sold the whole ball of wax to T. Mitchell Hastings and his General Broadcasting Corporation.
Doolittle retained ownership of WDRC-AM for a few more years, and it continued with a mixture of CBS network programming and some local personalities.
A guy on WDRC,
Bill Hennessy,
Russ Naughton, was doing the morning show over there.
This is the Yawn Patrol, and we'll be from now till 5 minutes of 7 with music on record, along with the time, temperature, weather forecast, news headlines, and baseball results, Hartford Wholesale Market Report. Herman Goodstein is in the control room this morning, mixing the grids and the biases and playing the records. And this is Russ Naughton in here in the padded cell. Are you all set, boy? Well, let's really arouse him this morning. Let's shake him right off the mattress with Nat King Cole and This Can't Be Love. That's for sure.
DRC in the late 50s and early 60s.
Rusty Potts.
You had Cal Colby. He was on the afternoon. He was called the Colonel. Morning teams, they had Reese and King.
Back to the Reese and King show with Jerry Bishop sitting in for Kenny, who was still in bed, sick. And we'll be here until 10 o'clock, so you stay with us. We have all kinds of music for you. The WDRC Spotlight song, These Things I Offer You by the Playmates.
6 and a half before 8, WDRC time.
Well, here we are. We're talking. The thing's playing there. It's not playing. Everything is quiet except me. I'm talking not loud now, and now we're going to play a little thing, right? The play, 1, 2, 3, with a play and go.
There he is.
What?
There goes Benny the Beeper. That's for our Bucks for Beep sound here at WDRC and the Reese and King Show.
That failed. They had Bacon and Faye. That failed.
Finally, in 1959, Doolittle sold WDRC to two executives from WNEW Radio in New York, Buckley and Jager.
And that was when he sold it to Buckley Jager. In 59, when Buckley Jagger went to buy it, they said, went to Doolittle and said, look, we want an FM, so you got to apply. Okay. We want you to apply for a new FM frequency. So he did. He applied for 102.9 and got 102.9, which is where it is today. So they took it over. It was a CBS radio outlet at the time. Yeah.
Which at the time still carried some network programming.
Jerry Bishop.
Like Arthur Godfrey and Gunsmoke and a few of those other things.
DRC had been a basic CBS station.
Jim Raynor.
Oh, you had a couple of the daytime serials. Arthur Godfrey was there. Things of that nature. And of course, CBS News.
That was, of course, the time when television was just taking everything over. Radio was struggling to find its voice, and disc jockeys became very prominent. Music was really the thing.
Charlie was an engineer originally at WDRC. He happened to have a natural talent for being a heck of a good announcer, but he didn't do that. He was the program director of DRC, and he knew that the programming tastes were changing, but nobody knew what direction to go in. So Charlie, in his infinite intelligence, decided to shop around to other markets of the country to see what was happening that was making radio so different. And what it was rock and roll. DRC made the decision to heck with CBS, we're going to go local independent, and we'll see what we can do in creating a new audience. And they did very successfully.
He actually was the one who made the decision to flip WDRC into a rock and roll station.
And then it was August 18th of 1960 when they changed it over to a Top 40 type format.
We went rock, Top 40.
The biggest day of the year is nearly here. Everything's coming up roses. Everything's coming up music, news, fun on Radio 1 starting Thursday, August 18th.
Everything's coming up roses.
To celebrate our new 20 hours a day of music and play, WDRC is proclaimed this Thursday, August 18th, as Fun Day, the biggest prize and surprise day ever. Listen.
First day was real crazy. Charlie had put together this big promotion deal where there were prizes given away almost every 15 minutes. Everything from bringing in the longest chain to the best fur coat or whatever, and you'd win a number of great prizes. It lasted, I guess, well into the evening. And we had lines of cars up, and it was just a lineup of Blue Hills Avenue at that time, which was unheard of. But that's what got us started.
He really had an idea of the sound that he wanted.
Steve Parker.
He wanted guys that really sounded like they were having a lot of fun. And it was all about being fun radio. WDRC, number one for radio fun. And
WDRC in Hartford. First for fun, we're number one. The fun spot to be is on Big D. 1360 in Hartford.
Charlie was a genius.
Dick Robinson.
But he was the brains behind the programming of Big D. He was a man that put together all the contests. He was a guy that did the music. He did everything. He was the brains behind the Fun Factory, and he was the fun in the Fun Factory. And Charlie was always laughing.
He wanted all the guys to have a certain energy to them. There was a certain Big D sound that he knew. He knew what that sound was, and it was something that he heard in his own mind. It was just something that a certain energy, a certain level of fun that he wanted out of his guys. All very professional, but they all had to have fun.
Friendly Five was DRC's five disc jockeys.
Joel Cash.
And that's the name that Charlie Parker had given them.
There was a great deal of camaraderie between the disc jockeys themselves, Jerry, Ron, Art, and myself. We had a good time together.
Of course, Ron Landry did the mornings.
In a world without love. Oh, what a great record. 24 minutes after 8, WDRC Fun Time on the live and lively Ron Landry Show. What's wrong? Why aren't you so happy? Why aren't you happy? You should be happy.
I got some real bad news today. You know, I sent my son to a very strict military camp for the summer.
Is that right?
I just got a letter back from the commandant of the camp. And my son was caught stealing jam.
Oh.
And they had a court-martial.
Oh.
And they shot him.
All the bits that he did, his subtle humor.
Ed Bruder.
His understated bits, all the things he used to cut during the commercials and then play back on the air to make it sound like it was a dialogue with himself, but using his different voice characters.
I'm down in the barbershop in the WDRC building. I didn't have a chance to get a good, clean, close shave this morning, and the WDRC barber is now about ready to give me a good clean close shave. Get a good and close now here.
I'll give you a real nice close one a day there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
Real nice close.
That's good.
You must have, when's your shave last?
Yesterday morning.
You got a nice beard on here. We can cut that real good and close, sir.
Yeah, good, good.
Oh, boy. How's that feel?
The razor's good.
Razor good and sharp! Oh, oh.
What? Well, what happened? What happened? What happened? What happened? What happened? What happened?
Oh, boy.
What happened?
Hey,
What happened? What happened?
Don't get excited.
What happened?
Don't get excited.
Wait, come on,
everything's
what happened?
Under control. Don't get excited.
What control? What?
Look, I have to run down to the drugstore for just a minute or two, and whatever you do, don't wiggle your left ear.
That was way above and beyond what most morning shows did.
Inventive genius is I think, a good phrase for what Ron was able to do. And he seemed to do these things so easily.
I would like to say just one thing at this time, folks. There are very few people in this world today who are perfect. However, this morning, Wayne Mulligan, our engineer, has hit that certain degree of perfection that will award him, that will get him the Ron Landry Award for 64. Everything, without a doubt, that he has done this morning has been perfectly wrong.
No.
Yes? How in the world can anybody make so many mistakes in so little time?
No.
It isn't easy.
Ron Landry was so far ahead of the rest of us because he was a man and we were boys.
Sandy Beach.
Ron Landry was an absolute consummate professional. I did the morning show there and later became part of Hudson and Landry, a comedy team.
Can you imagine Ron Landry? I mean, look at what he did. He went on to write a national network television show. He got very rich, very famous.
Joey Reynolds.
He was one of the top guys in Hollywood, you know, for a minute.
He went to California and started writing for a lot of sitcoms out there, and we just lost him a few years ago. He was a great guy.
Had Art Johnson, AJ at midday.
Art was a little more sophisticated, perhaps, in his approach to radio.
Jim Rayner.
When I came to DRC in 1959, Art was there, and of course, being basic CBS, and it was more of the old radio announcer type deals, and Art had grown up in that atmosphere and projected that, but did very, very well. He had a marvelous speaking voice.
And checking the WDRC mailbag, let's take a look here. The WSCS of the West Granby Methodist Church will sponsor a baked ham supper in the parish house on Thursday, September the 28th, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. Now, the tickets are $1.50 for adults, children under 12, 75 cents.
It was very, very smooth on the air and, you know, generally brought a sense of stability sometimes to our hilarity.
Jim Rayner.
I had the night show from 8 o'clock until 1 in the morning.
Number 56 on the Swinging 60s survey. We're checking into the top 100 tunes here during Rayner Shines. Started at 8, we'll be on the air all night long with WDRC after we finish the Swingin' Six. Best of them, we'll take over bringing you hits of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So we just start out with another action hour from the Fun Tower.
WDRC in Hartford.
I would estimate of an evening we answered between probably 250 and 300 phone calls a night.
Wish some New Year's greetings here to Kevin from Angel and to Stanley in South Windsor from Betty Jane. Clark and workout!
I think a big burr under the saddle of Sinet at that time, the Southern New England Telephone Company, they were up at the office almost every day complaining that we blew their circuits. And it was quite possible, but station manager would pat him on the back and say, well, we'll try to be good, but he knew deep down in his heart that wasn't about to happen. The more phone calls there were, the better it was.
We can't forget the Rayner bird.
Former WDRC sales executive Mike Drexler.
It was Jim Rayner had this character, the Rayner bird.
I had a sidekick named the Rayner bird. Mm-hmm. He was a 400-pound canary, you know, an invention, but we had a contest to name the Rayner bird. Lance was his name, I do believe.
Yeah, yeah. How's the crowd down there, Lance? Yeah. Huh? Yes, that sounds real wild, Lance. Don't fall off. Yeah, see you a little bit later, baby. All right. Oh, it sounded like they're having a good time there. Yeah, he always gets me nervous when he, you know, gets up to that height. And, oh, my goodness. He keeps swaying back and forth, which is a real wild bit. He does that anyway, but on the top of buildings, it looks real wild.
He drinks heavily. Lot of water, you know.
Charlie Parker had allowed us so much latitude in doing that. We came up with it, and then Charlie said, fine, let's go with it.
Yeah.
And he had such an inventive mind that, you know, if you said something that he really liked, he could take to heart, and he just ran with it all the way, give you all the latitude you wanted. And that was what was so great about him.
Jerry Bishop.
Here we go, the sound of Mr. Bobby Gregg, something called a jam part one, all right? With our fun word game, we continue on the Bishop Show, and we have placed our call to Mrs. Roland Crane of 44 Benton Lane, that rhymes, of Glastonbury. Mrs. Crane, how are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Are you all set to win some money?
Try. You gave me a rough word.
Okay, now the word, of course, is paint. And what do you think of when you hear the word paint?
Rough. I mean, I think of a house when I think of paint.
Is that going to be your answer?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you think of house. Now, let's listen and see what the story is. You can open up the envelope, and if the word that you have thought of is the same that's contained in the envelope, you'll win yourself a dollar. Okay, I'm sorry. The answer is brush. Paint and brush.
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, thank you very much for sending your card in, Mrs. Crane. But don't worry, we might call you again, because that's how the game works.
Thank you for calling.
And thank you very much for sending the card.
Exciting because everything was very new at the time.
Jerry Bishop.
And it wasn't just the Hartford area. We had, I mean, at sometimes we went on the air and we had 50% of the audience in the Hartford, Springfield, New Britain area. And it was very exciting because it was like the music a lot more simpler at the time. And we had the record hops and we had a bunch of things going and promotions and just generally it was a very exciting station to be on.
Art left, Jim Nettleton came and was there most of the time that I was there. Then Jerry left, and a guy by the name, he had a stage name of Long John.
Long John Wade was one of the giants of WDRC in the early to mid-1960s.
My love.
The WDRC Spotlight song for this week on the Long John Wade Monday Show for 4-13-64. Rick Nelson singing his brand new one. The very thought of you at 22 minutes before 7 o'clock, WDRC Fun Time.
A lot of people discount the role that he played with the Beatles in making them popular, but as he wrote to me in his later years before he passed away, he actually was one of the instrumental folks in getting the Beatles popular in those secondary markets like Hartford and like Cleveland. They were the markets where record companies really wanted to check the sales barometer. They wanted to see what was selling. And Capitol Records knew that when the Beatles started selling in Hartford that they had a hit for other national markets. Long John Wade helped that, certainly through playing the records on his afternoon show at DRC. But when he went on tour with the Beatles...
This is Paul McCartney, your resident DJ and newscaster, reporting from the hotel bedroom of the Beatles in New York.
Show me your papers.
I've got with me now a famous man who you've probably never heard of, John Wade. I know you don't really want to listen to him, because he's a load of rubbish, really. But here he is, sitting around giggling.
Long John Wade, by the way, we sent on the first Beatles tour all across the country. He was on the plane with the Beatles touring the country and did call-ins and really cemented our relationship with the Beatles with DRC.
It was just huge for DRC. He really could have been called the fifth Beatle, even though a lot of people say that Murray the K in New York was the fifth Beatle. Murray never traveled with the Beatles for an extended period like Long John did.
He took over Jerry's spot, and then I left. And Dick came in, Dick Robinson came in and took my place.
Dick Robinson!
Dick Buckley was a guy who owned WNEW in New York, and he was a big mentor of mine, and he owned a few properties, and he hired me to go up to Providence to run a station for him in Providence. When he sold it, he said, where would you like to go? And I said, well, I've always wanted to work at Big D.
WTRC is Hartford. Music City.
Hi, everybody, live from Music City. It's our Dickie Robinson program on a Friday. It's a wild day. We'll get some wild music for you. Stand by for all kinds of wild contests.
Because at that time, WDRC was a it was a fun station. You know, I was a young kid and the Beatles, 1964, that were just happening.
We're the top 100 countdown for 1964, the year of the Beatles, the year of John Paul, George, and Ringo. Now, what are you?
Fun radio station.
11:22, it's WDRC here in Hartford. Dickie Robinson program, and we're counting down the top 100 records of 66.
In fact, we called it the Fun Factory.
Hey, let's go to the phone line and talk to some of our people here. What do you think number one is?
Sunny.
Oh, yeah, Bobby Head. Thank you. All right, what do you think number one is?
I think number one is Hang on Sloopy. That's quick.
Hang on Sloopy?
Yeah.
I don't think that was even this year. Well, thank you anyway. Hi.
Percy Sledge, I think, is going to get it.
We're in the back. Hey, thank you very much. Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, what do you think number one is?
Number
one. Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How about that? Hi.
California Greeters.
By the, yeah, Mamas and Papas.
Yeah.
Yeah, we haven't got to that yet, have we? What else? What else haven't we got to yet?
What kind of a dedication?
Dedication? Number four, everybody, those are the Monkees. A big day in Hartford. Okay, what do you think number one's going to be?
When a Man Loves a Woman.
When a Man Loves a Woman by Percy Sledge.
Right.
And you were mentioning the other record?
Yep, that was California Dreaming, but I can't figure
out. What do you think that is?
I think it's two, but...
Number two?
If it's two, what's three? You know, if it's three, what's two?
Oh, so in other words, we've got three more records to play, but you can only think of two of them.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I can't figure the other one.
Hold on, and we'll find out, okay? Yeah, what do you think number one is?
Beatnik DJ.
Yes, sir, folks. And for those who don't remember that, let's not even go into that, right? Who do you think's number one?
I think it's California Dream.
Do you?
Yeah.
I say it's number three. Mamas and Papas here, California Dreamin'.
Strictly by Bertha Porter, they were chosen. And the way she did it was the way you should do it. You should play the records throughout the year. You call all the record stores. You found out what they were selling, how many they sold. And week after week after week, she would keep a tally of not records she liked, but how many were selling. And if they sold records, then they became number one for the week, number one for the month, number three for the month. Then for the year, they became the top whatever the year, all by local record sales.
This is the official one, of course, the only official one here in the Connecticut area, and this is what's happening. Record-wise, these are the ones that sold the most records compiled from our sales list in Hartford and Springfield and down there in New Britain, too, okay? This is the way it went.
Bertha Porter was the music director of the station. She was much older. I was in my early 20s, and she was much older lady, and she looked like a cleaning lady. Because she wore a black dress, and you were a wonderful, wonderful lady. But she was the music director of the year by Billboard magazine, and she was the powerhouse.
And Bertha was nationally known. She had a genius for picking out upcoming artists.
She could listen to a record. She could say, you know, this is going to be a hit. This will be top 10. This will maybe make it to 30, you know.
If Bertha picked a record to be played on WDRC, well then, everybody played it.
And she had a lot of connections. She really did.
I remember time and time again when you wanted to go see the Beatles, she was the one that got me in to see the Beatles. When Sonny and Cher came out with their record, I Got You, Babe.
I Got You, Babe.
And so one day she said, you want to go down and see Sonny and Cher? They're the number one act in the country, and they're on Atlantic Records. I said, yeah, we'll take a ride down. And so we rode down, and here is Ahmad Erdogan. If you watch the Ray Charles movie, he was depicted in the movie, and he was the kingpin of Atlantic Records. And Atlantic Records had a lot of R&B stuff like Ray Charles, but they had Sonny and Cher. So we walked in to this place in New York, and Sonny was there, and she was known to pull punches, and she said to Ahmad Erdogan, the president of the record company, along with Jerry Wexler, his partner, she was, Dick Robinson's here to see Cher. Now there was Sonny, you know, around, and she said, he don't want to see Sonny, you want us to see Cher. And the guy said, well, yeah. He said, Cher is over getting a pedicure at this beauty salon. So brother said, Dickie wants to see Cher. Get him a limousine and get him over there now. And the guy did it. It jumped or whatever Bertha Port had said because they knew her power. And I was over there probably 2 hours later interviewing Cher. But that's the kind of power she had. She had an ear for music, and also she would be diligent 24 hours a day about what she was doing. And she had power. Nettie only made probably about $90 a week. Nobody ever, she wouldn't accept anybody's payola.
So they used to come here from New York, and they used to really ask her to play a particular record. And she was incredible. If she didn't like it, there was no way on God's earth that the record was going to get played.
She did it all by the rules, and she was a good person, solid lady. And when she said something to you, which you very seldom did, you could take it to the bank.
She would pick all the music for the jock shows.
Wayne Mulligan.
She would handpick it, and she would pile it in a pile, and the jocks would have to come in, you know, an hour or two early before their shift, and they'd sit down at a typewriter with two sheets of paper and a piece of carbon paper, and they would type out their show as she had put it together. And then she would have a copy of it, and they would have a copy of it, and they would go on the air. And you'd better believe if they didn't play the music that she had picked for them in the order that she'd picked for them, that there was hell to pay when she got to, by the time she walked the 20 feet from her office to that studio.
One time I decided that I would kind of customize the music list because I didn't really want to play what she had written down. She actually came in, and there were witnesses to this. I think Robinson was there when it happened. She came in and started, while I'm on the air, beating me with her handbag. I mean, only Bertha Porter would do something like that.
Hey, Bertha, let me ask you something. Let me ask you one question. If you were a teacher and some kid came in after a seven-day vacation and he said to you, the kid was very nice. He came up to you and said, gee, I don't have my term paper because my dog ate it. Would you bite for that one? Or?
You know I'm tough. No.
You wouldn't?
You'd have to produce a paper.
You'd have to produce it?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you aren't very fair. That's not right.
I think that's fair. I mean...
Would you go for any excuse at all?
No.
No.
All I want is a term paper.
Get her out of here, will you, please?
WTRC. Hartford took the lead in a lot of things. You know,
yeah.
Back then, Hartford was also a leading test market for new products. If a manufacturer, Procter & Gamble, came out with a new soap or something,
You
know, oftentimes they would bring it out in Hartford first as a test market. So Hartford was a very important market for a lot of different things. But it was also a very important market, as you say, in the music field.
And in those days, if a record didn't make it on the outskirts of New York, it never got played in New York.
So Hartford was a focal point of all these record companies to get their product played on the air.
Bertha was phenomenal as far as her ability to pick a winner of a record. And that's why the radio station became so important to all these people, because they knew that if they could get Bertha to play their record, that they had a very good shot that it was going to be a hit nationwide.
And it was just an exciting time in really exciting time in radio, and everything was a lot of laughs, and you could tell by listening to it. You had Jerry Bishop on, you talked about, and Ron Landry and some other people that were on, Sandy Beach.
Dick Robinson, of course, became a good friend of mine and a legend in broadcasting in Connecticut, not only for his on-the-air stuff, but the Connecticut School of Broadcasting.
1964, we opened the Connecticut School of Broadcasting, and I owned it 100%. So we opened the school, and I had the studios in the Hotel America, but also used the Big D as the studios that were in Bloomfield as a place to... And the reason I did it is because I've been in broadcasting so long, and you couldn't find people who were taught what broadcasting was all about. They all thought they were going to make hundreds and hundreds of dollars at a time when people were being paid $47.50 a week and all the records you could steal.
He was the best man at my wedding, and Dick and I got along very, very well, and he was on the staff and did a great job promotionally for the station on the air and later in the business side of it. It was a lot of fun. They were all great personalities, and some of them still are, and it was a great great time to be there. The whole staff was talented, and you had to come in with your A game every day, or you'd get buried there.
Good morning, everybody. The Sandy Beach Show in progress. As you know, Linda Bird Johnson is being guarded by a well-trained team of Secret Service agents. Her chief agent is Harry Gardino, who is guarding her extensively.
Harry!
Nobody will get near her, not even Charles Robb. What do you think of that? I had another joke here, but if I told you what it was, they'd turn us into a parking lot by morning, so we're not going to do it.
He was great, Sandy.
Joey Reynolds.
You know, terrific. He's very smart. He's a smart guy. He now is on the air regularly as a talk host, but he was a good program director, you know. Pretty smart.
Did a lot of promotional stuff.
If the secret title of the hour is what you say, a duck will come down and will send $100 your way. Get a duck.
WDRC, Music Power.
I don't know what's happening. This station's going to the ducks there, or it's for the birds or something. I'm not sure. Here are new girls in the house.
We did almost all the rock shows that came to town. The worst moment I've had though, as a broadcaster, came in the Bushnell. We were bringing in the Beach Boys, and now if you bring in a big act, nobody introduces them. They introduce themselves, or they bring their own guy, or they have a produced intro. But at that time, they would always use the personalities to introduce them. So I'm going to introduce the Beach Boys at the Bushnell. Now, as you know, the Bushnell is where the symphony orchestra plays. The acoustics are perfect. It's unbelievable. So, okay, standing behind the curtain were the Beach Boys, all right? And there's a mic in front of the curtain, and it's time for me to introduce them. So I go out to the mic, but I don't walk out there. I kind of lope out there. That's what you do. And I went in like an inch too far, and my nose touched the microphone and got a static shock. And before I knew it, my brain didn't tell my mouth to do it. My mouth just did it on its own, uttered the ultimate four-letter F word in perfect acoustics at the Bushnell. Got a huge round of applause, and I didn't know how I was going to get out of this, because here are the Beach Boys. They're the hottest group in the world, okay? So as the crowd went wild, because the four-letter F word was not uttered in the 60s, believe me, not on stage.
Right.
It may have been in protest to Vietnam, but not on stage. And I took the mic, I looked off stage, and I said, okay, who's using that offstage microphone? Got a big round of applause. The Beach Boys loved it, and we brought them on, but I learned my lesson with that one. That laugh, the Sandy Beach laugh, was actually recorded at DRC. There, we used to do birthday stuff, and this guy with a weird name, I remember his name to this day, his name was Abner Nelms, and I could not get past his name. I really couldn't. I tried to catch it, and if you hear that laugh, if it's anywhere in the archives there, you'll hear that I couldn't really catch it.
Oh, this is terrible.
Get this. Williams Ford has two Shelby Cobra Mustangs to go to Connecticut Dragway. And imagine what those cars are worth today. And Joey and I went, I got pictures of Joey and I. We went to Connecticut Dragway and we raced them. And it's really a lot of fun when you're racing somebody else's car because it's somebody else's car. But Joey was my idol. He's one of the reasons I got into radio. He's a consummate professional.
And I said, well, I'm just being funny, you know. Well, who is Bob Hope to rank out the world? You know, what do you mean, who am I? We all know who I am. Who am I?
Joey.
Oh, there we go.
Joey Reynolds.
Oh, is that awful? Nobody can
guess the
champion.
Oh, wait a minute.
In Hartford, the hit of the day.
It's number one. Number one.
Somebody ought to put a postage stamp on your nose and mail you to a forest fire.
Joey Reynolds did not start his career in Hartford,
Ed Bruder,
but he did spend a couple of years, actually about a year and a few months, early in the 60s, working at POP as their night guy. He was still developing his act. He was still a young man, but it was clear even from the beginning that he was going to be brash, comic, very entertaining, and sort of really against the authority figures because he was there for the kids and he was all about the music. Of course, Joey went away for a few years, honed his skills in Buffalo, and then ended up in Detroit, and then landed at DRC, essentially in the first of 1967.
Well, then I came back. Then I came back. I came to Hartford. Right. Hartford then hired me. You know, the old man, Buckley, was very hot for me at that time because I was the number one jock in the country. Right. And I got fired in Buffalo. I nailed my shoes to the door and told him to fill these, which is the same thing that happened to me, except in Hartford, except that it wasn't business. So I came to Cleveland, Detroit. I was managed by Tony Mamarella, who was the producer of American Bandstand, put that on the map. The only manager I ever had, incidentally. And he was good friends with Bertha Porter. Ah, now you see the tie-in.
Okay.
And Tony loved Bertha. Thought she was great. So he said, you ought to go to work for Bertha Porter. And I said, Hartford, I've been there already. He said, no. He said, they're building a new station, and they're good people. And so Bertha thought I was, I think I was the last thing she wanted to see. Because they had put up with me a few years earlier at POP, you know. But then Charlie and I became friends, and I went to work there, and I worked with Bertha and with Charlie, and it was great. It was great.
Broadcasting as a community service of the University of Hartford, this is WWUH West Hartford, WAPJ Torrington, WDJW Summers, and WWEB Wallingford. And now back to Connecticut Radio Memories.
Starting Sunday, make the scene. Live. The Big D Time Machine.
He doesn't look like James Duran. He's a little pouchy there. That's my boss. He's a wonderful guy. It's not like working for anybody, working for dear old Charlie. Do you know that? Really. You know, it's not like going to work when you come here to DRC. It's like being in a country club. You know, everything is always so pleasant. And, you know, before I get carried away, where are you taking me?
We're carrying you away.
Wait a minute. You can't take me out of here. I'm back. That's what I love about radio. See, it's imagination, right?
He actually sat on the bench a couple of times for things that he did. He got suspended once for the elevator situation where he supposedly got stuck in an elevator at 750 Main Street.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, you know that WDRC was across from the cemetery on Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. So one of the managers, Bill Crawford, was never happy to have a less-than radio station. Now, don't forget, we're the number one station in Connecticut, beating the shit out of everybody. And TIC was Travelers Insurance Company at that time. And they were downtown. They were in that beautiful building, and we're sitting in this bunker out in the fields. So it was Crawford's desire to one day be uptown. And he convinced old man Buckley to have a 100-year lease on this building downtown. It was a heritage building. And they built a studio in the shape of a D, which I never got. I thought it was funny because how would you know it's in the shape of a D except if you saw it from the top, from a helicopter? I mean, nobody knew it was shaped like a D.
Yeah.
But our studio was downtown, and we had beautiful, very, very expensive studios. So the flaw was that the bathroom was on another floor. So here you have this gigantic $1 million, at that time a lot of money, studios. And to go to the toilet, you got to go on another floor. The men's room were alternate floors.
Yeah.
So I had to get in the elevator to go to the men's room. And I guess I got stuck with the record was playing. Not stuck like the other one, but I was late because the elevator didn't work. So after a couple of records, they were yelling up at me, and they put the wire down, you know, the microphone, so I did the show from the elevator. And it was funny, so I kept it going. That was what that was about. It was just goofy.
I remember looking out of the front of the building on the front block of 750 Main Street.
Steve Parker.
And a solid line of police cars and listeners all along that block in front of 750 Main Street. And they were all there trying to help Joey get out of the freight elevator. Yeah. And the police coming up to the radio station, and my father going, I'm not here.
Yeah. So here I'm sitting and stuck in an elevator doing the show because I went to the can. You know? Yeah. It was all about bringing the audience in and having fun. I'm going to wait till the midnight hour.
Do my love, don't stop a little now. Was another time when he played In the Midnight Hour, and they just kept the record stuck in the groove in a pre-planned stunt. I'm gonna take you, girl, hold you. Do all the things that I know.
In the midnight, in the midnight, in the midnight, in the midnight, in the midnight. One of those days we had needles on the turntable on the records, and the record, we had an engineer behind the booth, you know, and things stuck in the midnight. I thought it was funny. They kept going in the midnight, in the midnight, in the midnight.
And of course, listeners thought something was wrong, called the police, and they came down. I think Joey almost got arrested for causing a disturbance, but I guess he didn't.
And I kept it playing because I thought it was funny. And I did that for a long time, as I had done earlier years with Cherry. But Cherry, I played all the way through. It wasn't a stuck record. And I just remember, I just know how to get attention, you know? So the police came after about several hours and wondering what went wrong. You know, WDRC was a formal radio station, right? And they did not like to have anything, any commotion. But I brought a lot of this attention to the place by being over the top.
So the night before music, as we light the purple candles. George, hand it to me on the purple pillow. That's it. My people. People is the world's most exclusive organization. I think we already swore Ken Griffin into the Royal Order of Night People. And when you conduct your... You say these words. I will not be a dial twister. Or I will get a big D blister.
Elizabeth, I love Elizabeth. Even though you got a blister on your left quad, Elizabeth.
Oh, Richard. Shut up. What do you don't sound like Elizabeth.
And, of course, Joey had the infamous remark about Hartford's Lady Mayor, Ann Uccello.
They even at one time suspended me for calling the mayor. Ann Uccello was the first female mayor in the country. I called her a dumb broad on the air. So they were appalled by that. And they had to do something, so they suspended me for about a month.
Yeah.
And they had to do that through the union, you know. So I got suspended, and I came back after a month. I turned the mic on at 6 o'clock at night, and I said, she's still a dumb broad. And, you know, they got crazy again. But, you know, I was always having a hard time with form, with formality. Because to me, it was always Comedy Channel. You know, I mean, if you look now and you see Jon Stewart and all these guys, what the hell are they doing? They're doing the same thing I did, you know. But there was a place for it. You know, comedy is moving furniture in a living room and putting it where it don't belong. And if you take somebody's house and you move the furniture when they have a formal living room and you put the patio furniture inside the living room, they kind of don't like it. I mean, that's the way to describe it best, I think. You know, it's things out of frame. So that was my sense of getting attention and how to have fun. Plus, I always thought a lot of formal things were to be played with. But, you know, I mean, that's what people have done for years. That's Saturday Night Live. It's what the whole deal is, you know.
You never really knew what was going to come out of his mouth. And of all the people they had, he probably broke format there the most times.
And I got quite a roller coaster ride in Connecticut and gave the audience one, too.
Welcome to Joey Reynolds and his electric grandmother.
No.
Come on, I got to do the show.
Okay, what do you want to do?
I want to get out. Sit down.
You want to sit down? Oh, you want to sit down here? No, the changeover's done that. Oh, all right. Okay. You have your own earphones, so it's things you put on your ear?
No, I don't.
All right, go ahead. You got your
it's
own.
9 o'clock here on the DRC AM and FM in Hartford, Connecticut.
Ken Griffin.
Does
That's it, right?
Oh, no, I got to have my show before you do that. Oh. Wait a minute. Now, let's do it all over again and rehearse it. We got it right, Paul. Now, I'm sitting in the chair here, see? And Ken's going to come in as I say, ladies and gentlemen, we'll see you again tomorrow between 6 for the Joey Reynolds Show. Until then, remember to write to me if you want to marry me. Joey Reynolds, WDRC, Hartford, Connecticut. I'll send your application in to me, and I'll send a picture, too. And I'm going to get married, all right? Let a smile be your brother. Don't get a mouthful of rain. Good night, baby. See, I say good night over my steamer. I do it like this, I say. See you tomorrow between 6 for the Joey Reynolds Show. Until then, let a smile be your umbrella and don't get a mouthful of rain. Now, here's the real big class part. You ready? You ready for Big Ben for the chime? All right. It's exactly 9 p.m. Ken Griffin, showtime!
A lot of folks forget that before he worked at DRC, Ken Griffin had spent more than 3 years at WPOP as the nighttime jock, and he had a huge following there. He was always a very clever guy doing a lot of voice bits. He had his two characters, Fats Von Toon, the one and only lovable weather balloon, and Rocky Hill. They were his two sidekicks.
Fats Von Toon and Rocky Hill. I can't do the Fats Von Toon voice. She was the Fats Von Toon, the weather balloon, and I used to do a high voice. And then, of course, she married Rocky Hill. Hey, I'm Rocky Hill.
I'm Fats Von Toon.
That was it. Of course, it was higher then, but my voice is gone. But they had two babies, Pebbles and Pebblina, boy and a girl.
Yet, of course, all the voices were Ken's, and he did them all live. He very seldom recorded those bits.
This is the way radio used to be. It used to be fun.
Well, he had this huge following at POP, and all of a sudden, DRC calls in 1966, late in the year, and they said, look, Dick Robinson, who's been doing nights here for several years, is moving into sales. We need to have him on the air during a daytime shift. We need somebody at night to replace him. You're our guy.
They hired me over to DRC because I was making $250 a week, and they said, we'll give you $350 a week to come over here. So, hey, the name of the game back in the early 60s was money. The real money you made was not in the radio station. It was on record hops. We would do like two record hops a week, Friday and Saturday night. We'd get a bunch of records and a little tape recorder or something, and we'd make $100 and a quarter a night. So there's another $250.
So
now we're talking serious money here. Back then, that was serious money. In 1963, I was making $500 a week, doing nothing but saying, hi, how are you? Let's have a few laughs.
Beach Boys, all right, 27 away from 9. Big D's secret sound time on the Kenny Griffin thing, playing the top 20 sounds and the top 20 rebounds. The first station in the nation with 2020 music. Come on.
Fun is Big D in Hartford.
That actually caused a huge amount of dissent among loyal POP fans who felt that Griffin had become a turncoat and had left the station and was, you know, slapping them all in the collective face. So it took him a little time to establish the following at DRC, though he certainly was a familiar and known name in the market.
On WDRC, AM and FM in Hartford, Connecticut, this is The Scene of the Unheard with your host, Griffin.
Yes, with me, Scene of the Unheard. Yeah, well, it was back in the mid-60s when that kind of music came in. Rock and roll was going out and this new stuff was coming in. And we had AM and FM, and FM became the new thing. And they had Unheard, heavy metal and goofy music. It wasn't any more dip stuff. It was serious music. So we called it the Scene of the Unheard. And that's what we did. We did that for about 6 months. And that's all. What can I tell you? That was the beginning of FM.
Yeah, and you used the name Griffin then.
The only reason I had the name Griffin is because when I got my first job, my name was Joe Mulhall, and he said, we can't, Joe what? I said, Mulhall. Mule Hill? Mud Hill? How do we say, you can't go on the radio with a name like Mulhall. I said, well, all right, call me whatever you want to call me. Well, I don't care. No, but I just used the name Griffin because a friend of mine was named Ken Griffin, and I said, do you mind if I use your name on the radio? He said, no problem. So I did.
And he went on to do nights at DRC for another 4.5 years.
The 60s and 70s, when radio was what it was in the market, I was given by Charlie Parker the air name of Kent Clark.
Walt Pinto.
Charlie looked at me when I first walked in, before I'd started on the air there, and I had dark-rimmed plastic glasses, you know, in those days. And he said, "You look just like Clark Kent." And he said, "That's what we're going to call you," only he reversed the name. And
the Big D FM, Martha and the Vandellas and the Righteous Brothers before that with My Babe. And, of course, this is called Honey Child. Good afternoon. Final hour of the Lovable Kent Clark Show. Going out to everybody at the beach today. Hope you're enjoying yourself, no matter where you are, and hope you're taking us along. If you're heading for the beach, make sure you take us along.
I've got a root beer mug.
Stand by. I say stand by because I had something all set to go, and it didn't go. I'm going home.
Winner's Circle.
Hand.
I think I'll go to the beach.
I think it's so groovy now.
I really wasn't thrilled about having an air name, but in those days, everybody had air names because you had to have something catchy. Today, reality is the big thing, but I mean, Sandy Beach was an air name, but, you know, Ken Griffin's name is not his real name. Almost everybody else there. Don Wade was his real name, but an awful lot of people, you know, used phony names in those days. Sandy Beach, when he was in Springfield, was Jack Diamond, I think it was. So I, for that period of time, used the Kent Clark name that Charlie gave me, and then when I left DRC in 1970, to go to work for Dick Robinson, as a matter of fact, at the broadcasting school. I ran that for 4 years, and I still did some part-time work. I told Charlie when I left that if he ever got into trouble or needed somebody and couldn't find a replacement to let me know, and if I could do it, I'd do some shows. So I did quite a few shows, usually on the FM in the evening up there, because that's the only time I really could get away. But I still used, of course, the Kent Clark name because people remembered it, and they still remember it today. It's amazing. Charlie was right. It really stuck. Once you've heard it, you never forgot about it. I think one of the few people there who used his real name was Dick McDonough and Dick Robinson.
So I was at WKBR in Manchester, and I was there for about a year, and I was 23, and I asked my friend at KBR, who was an encyclopedia of jingles and program directors, radio stations across the country, and I said, "I understand there's a great station in Hartford." "Oh," he said, "WDRC, Charlie Parker." So I said, "I'm going to call him," and I called him when I was on the air that day, and he took the call, and he said, "Dick McDonough, you do a show at KBR from 3 to 7. And I thought, "How do you know?" And he said, "I was on a talent search, and your voice just got me and your personality. And out of everybody that I heard, I was going to call you Monday. You're at the top of my list." And I said, "What a coincidence." So I went to Hartford. Back then, you had to do live auditions. You'd send a tape, but he wanted you there in the studio, not on the air, in a production studio. And this was back in 1968, the end of the 68. And so I got there, and across the street, I was trying to think of it on the way over here to the studio. I think it was the White Castle that was where the Gold Building is now and has been for years, but it was a hamburger place. A lot of old-timers will remember, across from the Travelers Building at 750 Main, where we were, 15th floor. And there was a guy holding a waitress hostage with a shotgun. And, of course, Charlie was busy, and Walt Dibble, the late Walt Dibble, God rest his soul. And, you know, I think it was about 5 or 6 full-time news people at that station. It was a real radio station, full-service AM and Top 40. And so he said, "Dick," he said, "I'm sorry. I can't audition you today. We're just too crazy here." Kind of like Gnarls Barkley. Crazy! And so I said, "Okay, Mr. Parker." So I had to drive all the way back to Manchester, New Hampshire, which was forever. Do my show. Made an appointment to come back. He heard the audition. Mr. Buckley, not Rick Buckley Jr., but his dad, Richard Buckley Sr., who was a wonderful radio guy. He owned NEW in New York. And so he listened to my tape, and so he said, "Charlie, I like him, but it's up to you." He said, "I want him." So that's how it started.
Fun is Big D in Hartford, where the fun sound is.
And the Dick McDonough Show.
Tonight in Hartford, onto your ears. Countdown Extra. Medley at 2, Aquarius, and let some sunshine in.
Back then, we did a lot of live spots. And we were talking after every song back then, after every record. And they were like 2.5-3 minutes. So it was a lot of work to doing a 4-hour show.
And giving away every top 20 hit we play. This is number 20. And I'll take the 20th call for blood, sweat, and tears.
It wasn't in the days of music sweeps. And back then, it was just unbelievable, DRC. We were downtown. We were AFTRA, which is American Federation of TV and Radio Artists, SAG, Screen Actors Guild, and you had to be a member to work at that radio station. We were in a fishbowl. We were all glass everywhere. And we had a guy that was hired, especially this old Italian guy, and was a sweetheart of a man. And he would go around and just wash the windows all day, the glass, because there were so many tours. It was big time.
Of course, we've had Brad on in the morning forever. He started with us in April of 1977. And yes, he was doing music.
And I just loved radio. Always did. Always loved radio. And so Charlie Parker said to me, did you ever think about doing some radio for us? So he said, we've gone through a lot of morning people. And I said, oh, look, I'll give it a shot. And I did. And been there ever since. I auditioned. I'll never forget it. It was on the day before Easter. And I came and practiced on Easter Sunday because they said, we're going to give you a shot. And I'll tell you, it was tough because you had to spin your own records. You had to, and everything. But I caught on. Caught on. Made a lot of mistakes.
Here's a couple of favorites of mine. Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr. This is all about your love. It is 27 after 6. My name's Brad Davis. Nice to be with you here at Big D. Back on the radio. Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr., I Can't Do Without Your Love at 6:30 in the morning. This is a Monday, the 11th of April. I'm Brad Davis from WDRC.
You know, in my career, it's strange. There are turning points. It's here, and then you want to go to another level. And I was driving to work and did not know that Elvis Presley had died. So I'm on the air at 5 after 6 in those days, all right, not 5:35. So I'd get in early. I'd like to get in about 5 o'clock, an hour before the show, quarter of. So I was living in Newington at the time, and I was driving in listening to the radio. And the big news was Elvis Presley had passed. So I'm driving to work knowing that all of my music is picked for me by the record department. And I said, what am I going to do? I mean, Elvis is dead. I don't believe it. So I get to the station, and I remember it was about 4:45, and I don't go on until 6 o'clock. But the phone board was like a Christmas tree. So I started answering the phone, talking to the people. They were crying. They were beside themselves. So I said, well, I tell you what. I said, maybe this will be my last broadcast. But I said, I'm going to play the first song that's scheduled, and I still remember it, Smoke from a Distant Fire, the Townsend Band. And in the meantime, I had gone into the record library, gotten every single Elvis recording I could get, dumped all the rest of the records that were programmed on until 10 o'clock. And I just said, I'm going to play Elvis music and talk to the people. That's going to be my program. And knowing that they're going to flip out because I broke the format. You're not supposed to do that in Top 40 radio. So shortly after 10 o'clock, I'm in the office and Charlie Parker comes by, says, Dick Corson wants to see us, really see you. So I said to myself, this is it. I think that was my last program. So I went into the office and Corson's looking, he's very stern, tough. He said, I got to shake your hand. He says, that was one of the greatest radio broadcasts I've ever heard. I just want you to know that. I said, well, Dick, I certainly didn't expect this. I thought you'd probably can me for breaking format. He said, there's sometimes in radio, he said, you got to remember, Brad, radio is passion. You got to remember it's emotion. And he said, that's what you had this morning. That's part of your character. So I said, thank you very much. I felt like, wow. You know, I've made it. So that was one of the turning points. And then later on, I developed a club. Don't ask me how this happened, but I played David Rose's stripper music. You've heard that. And so I developed what I call the Brad Davis Squeaky Clean Club. And I just did it as a gag one morning, okay? And this was right after I came on at 6 o'clock. I said, any ladies out there like to take a shower? I'll wash your back for you this morning. And the phones lit up. I mean, I didn't think anybody. And I push up. This is Jane. This is Jane from West Hartford. She said, can you play that music? I said, of course, Jane. Are you ready to go in the shower? Let's get going. So I'd say, now I'm going to start with your shoulders. How's that feel? How's that? And she, oh, and you know, it'd be a big act, you know. And so I developed, that was a club. I had T-shirts, Squeaker Clean Club T-shirts. Well, one morning, I got a call, and there was a spokesperson in the area for ShopRite, Sylvia Gottlieb. Now, Sylvia Gottlieb was a very proper woman. She had the collar closed and the suits and the big bow tie and, I mean, stern looking and everything else. Well, this one morning, I punch up and this woman says, this is Sylvia and I want my back washed. I said, this is Sylvia? Yes, you know, Sylvia Gottlieb. I said, now, I said, you're funning with me. I said, Sylvia Gottlieb wants to join the Squeaky Clean Club? What did I tell you? So let's get going. Sounded just like her. Just like her. And I thought it was Sylvia Gottlieb. Okay? So I wash her back and do my whole thing. And again, at 10 o'clock, into Corson's office I go. He said, you are really stupid. He said, do you know that we're going to lose this account because you thought it was Sylvia Gottlieb? Do you know the woman that's on television? Have you ever watched her? Do you think she would ever, ever? Somebody did an excellent imitation. He said, I do admit that. But he said, look what you jeopardized. He said, I want you to do something right here in front of Charlie Parker and myself. I want you on the speakerphone to call up that woman and apologize. I said, okay. And he had the number. And I called up, asked for Sylvia Gottlieb. Who is this? It's Brad Davis. Could you please tell her that I'm on the line? Hello, this is Sylvia. I said, Sylvia, this is Brad Davis. And I said, I'm in Dick Corson's office, and Charlie Parker is with us too, our program director. And I want to apologize for this morning. Somebody sounded just like you and imitated you in my Squeaky Clean Club shower. She said, Brad, nobody imitated me. That was the most wonderful backwash I have ever had in my life. And Corson looks at me, he says, get out of my office. Get out of my office. So that was another highlight of my career. And Sylvia and I became fast friends. She used to go to the Russian Lady with me.
And let's see, when did we go talk? I would say, anyway, it was a part-time thing at first. So I would say this was probably about 03, maybe, when we really went, you know, headlong into the talk arena.
You know something? All I know is that talk was starting to happen. So it was perfect for me because actually I had a news background. I'd done a lot of interviews on Three, and so I did What's Happening, and that was investigative reporting. So when they transitioned over to talk, I love it.
When I was in Hartford, DRC had just a sensational news department. I think they had Joe Barbaret and Alan Shepard and Mike Millard, a lot of top-notch personnel.
Good news from Quinnsville, USA. Mrs. Fisher expecting again. 73 degrees at 8, Barbaret reporting for G. Fox & Company, Southern New England's largest, most exciting store in downtown...
A false report from Moscow. Grissom and Young named for Gemini flight. 56 degrees at 7, Nettleton reporting. In the words of the director of the official Soviet news agency TASS, it was a silly rumor. These terse comments wrote the final chapter in a brief but stormy drama that started with a mistranslation, and during its high points had millions of persons all over the world believing that Premier Khrushchev was dead.
On WDRC, AM and FM in Hartford, it's 67 degrees at 8 o'clock, and this is Walt Dibble with the stories that top the news at the top of this hour. Plans for live television from the Apollo 10 were canceled this evening, no special reason given.
On WDRC, AM and FM in Hartford, it's 34 degrees, and this is Aaron Shepard with the 2 o'clock Ear Witness News.
I think there was a time when we had probably the best station in the country because we were the best people in the country and assembled. I mean, not, you know, singularly there have been excellent people everywhere, but we were all in one place at one time, and that was exceptional.
Without Charlie Parker and Bertha Porter, there wouldn't be a DRC as we know it.
Charlie very possibly was the best programmer in America. He was a genius. He put together so many incredible things that I don't think POP ever quite caught up. I know they didn't in the ratings, and a lot of times it was neck and neck, but there was a serious competition.
WPOP was our competition. Kenny Griffin was good. Lee Baby Sims was good. But basically, DRC was the place to be.
It was a wonderful place. There's a spirit you can't explain. It's when things are where they're supposed to be and they're done for a special reason. So Charlie's great. Charlie's great. And he's a one-of-a-kind guy, and it was a special time. Bertha and Charlie worked great together. They were able to form this unholy matrimony, putting records and radio together. That was the game, you know. The game was the marriage of radio and records. And subsequently, when the magazine came along years later, it was called Radio and Records. And all started in Hartford. I mean, you know, for a medium-sized market, we kicked ass. And that's the story. I mean, it's a true story. It's documented.
In 2014... Buckley Broadcasting sold WDRC and its affiliated stations to Connoisseur Media. This program is dedicated to those who participated in interviews but who passed away before the program was finished. Lonnie Jerev, Jack Lenhoff, Joe Mulhall, air name Ken Griffin, Fred Swanson, You've been listening to Connecticut Radio Memories, Episode 1. This program was produced and edited by Brandon Camp. Thanks to everyone who participated in interviews for the series, including those whose comments didn't make it to air. Interviews were edited for time, continuity, and clarity. Special thanks to WTIC News Talk 1080 and CBS Radio for allowing us to use archival audio, and to Jeff Hugabon, the chief engineer of WTIC, who is also curator of their archives. Special thanks to David Kaplan, webmaster of the WTIC alumni website. This series would not have been possible without the air check collectors and other people and organizations who had the foresight to save air checks, jingles, or theme songs, and who shared them with us, including Ed Bruder from ManForMars.com and WDRCOBG.com, Rick Kelly of Northeast Air Checks, Jeff Hugabon, Dick Bertel, David Kaplan, Dick Robinson, Tracy Carmen. We want to send a shout-out to Bill Hennessy and the bunch of old broadcasters who meet monthly to hear the Hartford Jazz Orchestra play at the Arch Street Tavern. Special thanks also to John Ramsey of HartfordRadioHistory.com. Connecticut Radio Memories was produced at the studios of WWUH-FM at the University of Hartford.
I like to stay in places like the Greenwich Inn. When I sight a new cat, I say, man, like, give me some skin. I play a mean guitar. My voice has that sound.